Welcome. This is the New England Journal of Medicine. I'm Dr. Michael Bierer. This week, August 21st, 2025, we talk about lung cancer, vasomotor symptoms in breast cancer, autoimmune pulmonary alveolar proteinosis, and high-risk cutaneous squamous cell carcinoma. A review article on educational strategies for clinical supervision of AI use. A case report of a woman with fatigue and myalgias, a sounding board on vaccine policy in the U.S., and perspectives on preventive care at the Supreme Court, regulating private equity in healthcare, reforming the prescription drug user fee program, and on the consultant. Overall survival with neoadjuvant nivolumab plus chemotherapy in lung cancer by Patrick Ford, from Trinity College Dublin and co-authors. In a phase 3 trial involving patients with resectable non-small cell lung cancer, NSCLC, neoadjuvant nivolumab plus chemotherapy significantly improved pathological complete response and event-free survival in those patients. The investigators now report the results of a planned analysis of overall survival in the study's patients. 358 patients had been concurrently assigned to receive nivolumab plus chemotherapy or chemotherapy alone. The final analysis of overall survival significantly favored neoadjuvant nivolumab plus chemotherapy over chemotherapy alone. No new safety signals were observed. Editorialist Virginia Calvo from the Hospital Universitario Puerta de Hierro Majadahonda, Madrid, writes that the trial by Ford and co-authors led to the approval of neoadjuvant nivolumab plus chemotherapy, a major shift in the treatment strategy for patients with NSCLC who have potentially resectable disease. This trial also illustrates the importance of flexibility and adaptability in trial design by allowing for the incorporation of emerging research results. The choice between neoadjuvant and perioperative immunotherapy in patients with NSCLC remains challenging because of the limited evidence and absence of head-to-head trials. Although perioperative regimens offer greater flexibility, they may lead to overtreatment, which can have negative clinical and economic consequences. Decisions should continue to be individualized with extensive weighing of risks and benefits, along with ensuring the engagement of patients. The trial by Ford and co-authors represents a therapeutic advance and underscores how scientific progress, adaptive trial design, and international collaboration can improve the prognosis of diseases that historically have been associated with poor outcomes. With the development of perioperative immunotherapy and chemotherapy, the goal of treatment has shifted beyond just prolonging survival. These latest advances in therapy appear to offer the realistic prospect of cure for a substantial proportion of patients. Elinzanetant for vasomotor symptoms from endocrine therapy for breast cancer by Fatima Cardoso from the Champalimaud Clinical Center, Lisbon, Portugal, and co-authors. Women receiving endocrine therapy for hormone receptor, HR-positive breast cancer, or its prevention among those at high risk for breast cancer, commonly develop vasomotor symptoms, such as hot flashes. This phase 3 trial evaluated the effects of elinzanetant, a neurokinin-targeted therapy shown to be effective in treating vasomotor symptoms in this population. 474 women 18 to 70 years of age were randomly assigned in a 2-to-1 ratio to receive once daily elinzanetant for 52 weeks or once daily placebo for 12 weeks, followed by once-daily elinzanetant for 40 weeks. Elinzanetant led to a significantly lower frequency of vasomotor symptoms associated with endocrine therapy than placebo. During weeks 1 through 12, 69.8% of participants receiving elinzanetant and 62% of those receiving placebo reported at least one adverse event that occurred while receiving elinzanetant or placebo, with the most common being headache, fatigue, diarrhea, and somnolence. Anne Partridge from Dana-Farber Cancer Institute, Boston, writes in an editorial that among women with a history of early breast cancer treated with endocrine therapy, tamoxifen or aromatase inhibitors, vasomotor symptoms are common, occurring in up to 90% of this population, and often severe. These symptoms are attributable to mainstay treatments used to reduce disease recurrence and improve survival. In the trial by Cardozo and co-authors, elinzanetant resulted in greater sustained decreases in the frequency of vasomotor symptoms than placebo at both 4 weeks and 12 weeks. The difference between the trial groups was both significant and clinically meaningful. A better understanding of the real-world prevalence and acceptability of associated side effects, including somnolence, fatigue, and diarrhea, which were more common among the participants who received elinzanetant than those who received placebo in the first 12 weeks, will be critical to incorporating this drug into patient-centered care. The present trial supports elinzanetant as a promising new treatment for persons with breast cancer with bothersome vasomotor symptoms while receiving endocrine therapy. Phase 3 trial of inhaled molgramostim in autoimmune pulmonary alveolar proteinosis by Bruce Trapnell from the Cincinnati Children's Hospital Medical Center and co-authors. Autoimmune pulmonary alveolar proteinosis, APAP, is a rare disease characterized by progressive surfactant accumulation and hypoxemia caused by autoantibodies against granulocyte macrophage colony-stimulating factor, GM-CSF, which alveolar macrophages require to clear surfactant. Molgramostim is a formulation of inhaled recombinant human GM-CSF, but its efficacy and safety in patients with APAP have not been studied sufficiently. In this Phase 3 trial, 164 patients with APAP were randomly assigned to receive molgramostim or placebo once daily for 48 weeks. The primary endpoint, which was the change from baseline in the diffusion capacity of the lungs for carbon monoxide at week 24, was chosen because it is a standardized measure of gas transfer that is widely used in clinical practice. Once daily inhaled molgramostim led to a greater increase in pulmonary gas transfer than placebo in patients with APAP. In a Science Behind the Study editorial, John Seymour from the Royal Melbourne Hospital, Australia, describes the foundations of the trial by Trapnell and co-authors. The trial represents an important step forward in the treatment for APAP and should establish inhaled GM-CSF as the standard of care for this debilitating disease, replacing the burdensome treatment of whole lung lavage. Moreover, it elegantly completes the virtuous path of bench-to-bedside translational research, serendipitously initiated in experiments on mice more than 30 years ago in pursuit of knowledge of the biology of hematopoietic growth factors. Adjuvant cemiplimab or placebo in high-risk cutaneous squamous cell carcinoma by Danny Rishin from the Peter MacCallum Cancer Centre, Melbourne, Victoria, Australia, and co-authors. Patients who have cutaneous squamous cell carcinoma with high-risk features are at risk for recurrence after definitive local therapy. Cemiplimab, a programmed death 1 PD-1 targeting antibody, is approved for the treatment of locally advanced, that is, not suitable for resection, or metastatic cutaneous squamous cell carcinoma. This Phase 3 randomized trial compared adjuvant cemiplimab with placebo in patients at high risk for recurrence of cutaneous squamous cell carcinoma after surgery and postoperative radiotherapy. 415 patients were assigned to cemiplimab or placebo. The median follow-up was 24 months. Adjuvant cemiplimab therapy led to longer disease-free survival than placebo among patients at high risk for recurrence of cutaneous squamous cell carcinoma. The safety profile of cemiplimab in the context of adjuvant therapy was consistent with the known safety profile of cemiplimab monotherapy in the context of advanced or metastatic disease. Educational strategies for clinical supervision of artificial intelligence use. A review article on medical education by Raja Eli Abdelnour from Brigham and Women's Hospital, Boston, and co-authors. Recent technological developments in medical AI have resulted in more effective and potentially more dangerous interactions. Although the hype around AI resonates with previous technological revolutions, such as the development of the internet and the electronic health record, the appearance of large language models, LLMs, seems different. LLMs can simulate knowledge generation and clinical reasoning with human-like fluency, creating the appearance of agency and independent information processing. Therefore, AI has the capacity to fundamentally alter medical learning and practice. However, as in other professions, a concern is that the widespread use of AI in medical training could result in professionals who are highly efficient yet less capable of independent problem-solving and critical evaluation than their pre-AI counterparts. Such a challenge presents educational opportunities, but also poses risks, such as de-skilling, never-skilling, or miss-skilling. The authors of this review propose a structured framework, Deft AI, that leverages educational strategies to teach and assess critical thinking during clinical supervision of trainees wherever AI is being used. Deft AI, diagnosis, evidence, feedback, teaching, and recommendation for AI use, is conceived with the purpose of promoting critical thinking and AI literacy during learner AI interactions. Two AI use behaviors emerge, aptly termed cyborg, tight intertwining of user and AI for each task, and centaur, division of tasks between user and AI, with critical oversight. Adaptive AI practice requires the ability to shift between these behaviors according to the complexity of the task and the risk involved. A 32-year-old woman with fatigue and myalgias, a case record of the Massachusetts General Hospital by Deborah Gomez-Kwolek and colleagues. A 32-year-old woman presented with fatigue, myalgias, and chest pain following a recent SARS-CoV-2 reinfection. She had a history of long COVID symptoms and lived in a wooded area with regular outdoor exposure. Initially, she developed neck pain that progressed to radiating arm pain, palpitations, and positional chest tightness. Electrocardiography revealed Mobitz type 1, second-degree, and first-degree atrioventricular block, later progressing to complete heart block. Laboratory tests showed elevated NT-proBNP and mildly increased liver enzymes, but normal inflammatory markers. Lyme carditis was suspected based on her clinical presentation, outdoor exposure, and arrhythmia. Serologic testing confirmed infection with Borrelia burgdorferi, and a photo she later shared revealed a prior erythematous rash consistent with erythema migrans. She was diagnosed with early disseminated Lyme disease with cardiac involvement. The Path Forward for Vaccine Policy in the United States, a sounding board by Helen Chu from the University of Washington Schools of Medicine and Public Health, Seattle, and co-authors. For the past several decades, the vaccine approval process began with a review of relevant clinical trials by the Food and Drug Administration Vaccines and Related Biologics Advisory Committee, followed by FDA licensure or emergency use authorization. The Advisory Committee on Immunization Practices, ACIP, then made recommendations for clinical use. Given the careful review of the evidence and extensive deliberations, past CDC directors have rarely overridden ACIP recommendations. The ACIP has been an independent committee of vaccine scientists and clinicians that has relied on a process called the Evidence to Recommendations Framework. This deliberative framework calls for a review of the strength of evidence around a variety of factors, including the magnitude of the public health problem, potential benefits and harms, values, acceptability, resource use, equity, and feasibility. The discussions are technically complex and require a deep understanding of the clinical trial under consideration and epidemiological data and the societal, clinical, economic, and practical implementation aspects of vaccination. The nation now faces a scenario in which the rigor and discipline of these vaccine recommendation processes are rapidly eroding. The ACIP cannot be replaced, but it may be possible to limit the damage with a centralized approach. Preventive Care at the Supreme Court, a perspective by Nicholas Bagley from the University of Michigan Law School, Ann Arbor. In a win for public health, the U.S. Supreme Court's June 27, 2025 decision in Kennedy v. Braidwood Management upheld the power of the U.S. Preventive Services Task Force, USPSTF, to issue binding recommendations governing which preventive services must be included in insurance coverage. At the same time, the court confirmed that the U.S. Secretary of Health and Human Services, Robert F. Kennedy Jr., with his notoriously eccentric views about medicine and science, can exercise tight control over the task force's decisions. The court reasoned that the HHS secretary is free to remove task force members for any reason or for no reason at all, a powerful method of control. The secretary also has the power to block USPSTF recommendations from taking effect. Going forward, Braidwood confirms that binding USPSTF recommendations are constitutional only because the HHS secretary can exercise strong control over the task force. How Kennedy will use that authority remains to be seen. The case will now return to the lower federal courts for further proceedings. Regulating private equity in healthcare. The Massachusetts Model, a perspective by Thomas Tsai from the Harvard T.H. Chan School of Public Health, Boston. On January 8th of this year, Massachusetts Governor Maura Healey signed into law House Bill HB 5159, perhaps the most far-reaching state legislation in the United States aimed at curtailing the influence of private equity in healthcare. The collapse of the Steward healthcare system, which had been owned by a private equity firm and a real estate investment trust, laid bare the blind spots in current regulation of hospitals, including ownership by private equity firms and shell corporations, failure to disclose financial losses, rental agreements to real estate investment trusts, and defaulted payments to vendors. The Trump administration's skepticism toward federal regulation may make states central to any efforts to address the growth of healthcare private equity, and HB 5159 could serve as a model for other jurisdictions. The key provisions of the Massachusetts law fall into three main categories: requirements for disclosure or notification, limitations on certain potentially problematic financial transactions by private investors in healthcare facilities, and increased liability for investors for their organization's fraudulent activities. Though there remain gaps in HB 5159, Massachusetts' current statutes on curtailing the influence of private equity and financial actors in healthcare arguably qualify as the most stringent in the country. Reforming the Prescription Drug User Fee Program, a perspective by Therese Ziax from the Yale School of Public Health, New Haven, Connecticut, and co-authors. In May 2025, the Food and Drug Administration took the first steps in the reauthorization process for the Prescription Drug User Fee Act, PDUFA. PDUFA is one of seven user fee programs, each associated with a particular category of FDA-regulated products that augment congressional appropriations to fund FDA operations, including hiring staff and supporting data systems. In fiscal year 2024, user fees accounted for 48% of the FDA's nearly $7 billion budget, including 69% of its budget for the regulation of small molecule drugs and 53% of its budget for the regulation of biologics. Over time, the scope of user fees and the FDA's reliance on them has grown. The current PDUFA cycle expires in September 2027. The FDA has begun soliciting feedback to inform the next version of the legislation, PDUFA 8. However, there is substantial uncertainty surrounding PDUFA's future. The Secretary of Health and Human Services has expressed support for eliminating user fee programs because of concerns about industry influence. A newly appointed deputy commissioner suggested that the FDA is considering restructuring the PDUFA program, and critics of PDUFA have raised concerns about potential conflicts of interest since the program's enactment. The Consultant, a perspective by Tessa Adzemovich from the Brigham and Women's Hospital, Boston. Just months into medical school, students often find that family and friends seek health advice from them. Residency training only ushers in more medical questions from relatives and strangers alike. The phenomenon is often joked about, but it's an undeniable reality. Sometimes these consults are amusing, others are much harder. Of course, such consults are never true medical care. Dr. Adzemovich's first response is typically, "What did your doctor say?" But in a system in which patients can wait months to years for a new patient appointment, it's not surprising that people turn to physician acquaintances for answers. According to the American Medical Association Code of Medical Ethics, treating oneself or a member of one's own family poses several challenges for physicians, including concerns about professional objectivity, patient autonomy, and informed consent. It recommends that physicians do so only when necessary, such as for emergencies or when there are limited options. But it seems that physician consults with friends and relatives are just another vector for unequal care in the United States, another way in which the gap between rich and poor, connected and disconnected, is widening. So perhaps the question is less about whether physicians should tend to their family and friends, and more about how to increase access to adequate healthcare services for all. Our images in clinical medicine show a paraganglioma of the organ of Zuckerkandel. A 39-year-old man presented with a one-day history of lower abdominal pain. The blood pressure was 203 over 132 millimeters of mercury. Imaging revealed a retroperitoneal mass inferior to the aortic bifurcation. Another image shows the abdominojugular reflux test. A man with heart failure presented with 2 weeks of shortness of breath. The jugular venous pressure was seen at the angle of the jaw and increased for more than 10 seconds when pressure was applied to the abdomen, shown in a video at nejm.org. Read more from our issue at nejm.org. Let us know what you think about our podcast. Any comments or suggestions may be sent to audio@nejm.org. Thank you for listening.